Sir Raymond John Avery, known to many Kiwis as Ray Avery. He's an inventor, a scientist. He was New Zealander of the Year in 2010. He was born in Kent in England, and he grew up in orphanages and foster homes. He has said that just surviving his childhood was the hardest thing he's ever done. But he didn't just survive, he managed to thrive. At 14, he was sleeping on the streets. He was starting to be picked on, questioned by, looked out for by the police. Let's call it getting into potential trouble. So he was smart enough to seek a safe, warm haven in the local library. And that was where he began to educate himself. But what from there brought him to our shores, to New Zealand, where he has contributed so much and continues to do so? Sir Ray Avery joins us today for a wonderful kōrero. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
I want to begin with that story of living on the streets before we look at your own trajectory, because that ties in with a product you are launching, which is providing potentially food for children who are hungry and homeless people who are hungry and cold on our streets. What is the product, Ray?
Well, we're launching a product called, it's an Amigo bar. It's actually developed not just by me, but by the children of New Zealand. In fact, the children of the world. We got them to devise their own. They chose the logo from a whole range of logos. They chose the flavors. They chose the branding. They chose the tagline, which is turning hangry faces into happy faces.
It's gorgeous and growing great New Zealanders. Essential nutrition in one bar. I'm immediately suspicious because a lot of muesli bars sure. are full of sugar and they're sure. rubbish. They're sold as healthy and they're full of rubbish. So what's different?
Well, because it was invented by me. what I did was to look at what are the problems with nutrition. So we looked at what are the key things. So in 2002, the New Zealand government did a survey of 5,000 children and looked at what are the deficiencies that those children had. And just to give one example, zinc was one of the major ones. And zinc's a really good precursor of clinical outcomes. If you don't have enough zinc, you get all sorts of problems with memory and aggression and so on. So we reversed engineered it and said, what do we need to put in the bar? And so what we put in the bar was the things that we really need. And the things that we didn't want were the things that caused allergens and so on. So we looked at it much more from a pharmacological perspective because that's been my training. And so everything that's in that bar is there for a reason. It's not there just as a thickener or an emulsifier to make a bar. And we, as far as the sugar goes, when we first started trialing it on kids, we tried to get the sugar down to really nothing. And the kids were going, oh, that was horrible. And so we built it up to a point where we could get the right amount of sugar. So it only has the smallest amount of sugar for any bar on the market. But it still tastes great to the kids. And that was the important thing. They tasted it. They chose the flavors. And then they selected the flavour that they thought tasted best.
It's really interesting because when you look at the ingredients, they're always in the order of concentration. And sugar is low down here. I mean, there's fruit puree and fruit concentrate. So that would add some sweetness. Yeah. But what have we got in here, Ray? Tell us some of the ingredients.
Oats, of course, are the, you need fibre. Fibre is one of the things that we lack in our diets generally. So a normal diet in New Zealand often is deficient in fibre, and that's important to get your bowel working. Sounds horrible, but you've got to get your gut working. And some of the other ingredients, for instance, the sugar that we've chosen comes from sugar beet, and it has a low glycemic index, which means you don't get a sugar rush, and it means that you get a longer burn of sugar through your digestive system.
It sort of drip feeds
the
blood.
It drip feeds it. And the other thing that's more important is that because it releases so slowly and it actually releases only in the gut, what happens is that it's tooth friendly, and the FDA have approved that sugar that we use in our product as a tooth friendly. We can't use that claim in New Zealand because it hasn't been approved, but in the States I could sell it as saying this is a tooth friendly sugar. So we thought about every single ingredient that goes into it and left out all the stuff. There are probably 8 ingredients that are allergens, and they can be soy and things like that. Mm. A lot of the bars you'll find on the market will have soya in them, and soy principally sounds like a good ingredient, but when you make soy, typically you defat it with things like hexane at worst case and alcohol as a secondary product. And so the processing of many of these things that we put into our food has been very chemically processed, whereas we use pea protein. All we did was mix it with some water and precipitate out the protein and dry it. So that to me is a safer way of making ingredients.
It's smart, and those awful trans fats and things like canola oil that's implicated in macular degeneration, all of these cheap, nasty oils that are in a lot of bars, people don't know how to look out for it. But here we've got, we seem to have a really impressive lineup, even chicory root fibre.
Well, chicory root fibre is a product called inulin. Inulin is a prebiotic, and it helps you to grow good bacteria in your gut.
That's brilliant, because there is more and more research about the brain and gut connection, and that it's linked with intelligence and, as you say, hormonal health, isn't
it? So the other thing that we've done, which is really interesting, is that not only did we look at the ingredients for the customer, but what is the impact on our environment? So there's no animal protein, because animal protein is just not sustainable for our environment in the long term. And that's why we're seeing huge amount of IPO companies doing artificial meat and so on. So, you know, dairy is the same thing. It's very intensive in terms of carbon footprint. And so if we can get rid of all that, so we didn't just look at what it's for the patient or the end user, but what it's going to do for our planet. So this is the first environmentally sound, very safe. Safety was one of my great things, you know. Although dairy allergies are only probably, depending on who you believe, between 1% and 8%, if you can get rid of them, why not?
How about your wrapper? Is it able to break down easily?
Yes, it is. But again, what I like is that my daughters are now experimenting. In my eldest daughter Amelia is in my laboratory. She's making her own plastics at the moment, which are biodegradable.
Fantastic.
Because she wants to be involved.
Yes. So you can't say it is good because it is plastic, but you are working on it.
It is. This one's recyclable, biodegradable, but yes, it's not as good as we would want it to be.
So I love that, Ray. I tested you there because you're willing to say, no, I'm still a work in progress. I'm still making it better and better. What was the vision for this? Where did this come from?
Well, it was really, it goes back to my childhood being under the railway bridge and not, you know, not knowing what hunger is and begging for food at the end of the day. I used to have to go to the shop at the end of the road, which was a bakery. And on Friday, they would chuck out all of the stale buns. So I would go to them. And that was a good part of social marketing, because I'd go to them when I first went in with my school uniform and said, have you got any stale buns? They said, go away. I went out and sat outside, and I didn't know what to do, and I sat on this little seat outside, and it started to rain, and I just sat there because I didn't know anywhere else to go. But one of the women came out after about 3 or 4 hours, and she had a little bag, and she gave it to me on the way out. And that's when I realized that I could connect with people. So by the time I'd seduced all these ladies in the shop on a Friday, they had a package ready for me.
There's a wonderful cupboard up at the top of Ponsonby Road, just near the mobile station, and you can go and put food in there every afternoon. And last winter I was going around cafes at 4 o'clock. It's amazing how generous people will be. And
that's
I
right.
love
if you get,
putting
if you give
it
them
in
the opportunity
for the homeless and the hungry. And but so, Ray, how did you end up there? Let's begin at the beginning, where you were put in orphanages. How did that happen? What happened with your life story?
Well, my mother and father met as a post-war fling. My father had come back from a prisoner of war camp. He'd been in a prisoner of war camp for 5 years, got back to England, and then after a year he met my mother, and they had a romance and got married, and I was one of two children that were born from that marriage. And but they didn't like each other much, and my father was a career womanizer and my mother was an alcoholic, and so it was a horrible environment. We'd get beaten up a lot. My sister got sloughed off somewhere very early on in the piece, and I was left with my mum. My father had taken off with some other woman, and I, you know, I loved my mum and I wanted to look after her. She worked as a cleaner in the hospital, so I'd walk up to meet her from the hospital where she was cleaning, and depending on the day, she would be kind, or on a bad day, she'd beat me, and you know, if I forgot to get the bread, I would be beaten. And so there was one occasion when I was chopping up firewood and outside, and she came out, and she used to make these meals for me, these fried eggs for my evening meal. She'd cook them before she went off to work, and I'd come home at 4 and I'd have to have that meal. And there'd be these congealed eggs, which were horrible. And I used to not want them, so I used to go off and put them into the hedge and hide them. And she found them, and that was a bridge too far, and she just beat me unconscious, and I ended up in hospital. And then the social workers found me, and I just fessed up and said, my mum beats me all the time. And then I was taken into care. And that was the beginning of just being put through a whole series of different orphanages and a series of abuse that went on in those places, because there were probably 400,000 kids from the bombing in the war, and they were put into these halfway houses. Nobody knew what was going on. They weren't organised. They were often a country estate that had been turned into an orphanage. So there were beds in the corridors, and you know, there was one bath, and you bathed in alphabetical order. And I was bloody glad my name was Avery, because I'd get into the bath quickly, because it was just scum at the end of the day, you know. And we had one pair of shoes, one pair of shorts, and two shirts, and a couple of pairs of knickers, and that was it. And so it was a very brutal kind of existence for the first 14 years.
Great. Even be able to find something to laugh about in the middle of that story is extraordinarily resilient. You must have had an inner light, an inner resilience to get you through that. What do you think got you through?
Well, I think there's this big discourse, whether it's nurture or nature, and I'm a firm believer that you come with your own CD. Looking at my own children, they're pre-programmed. Mm. They're who they are. Mm. And for whatever reason, I had that gene that said, I'm going to survive. And I did whatever it was necessary to survive that. But what it did give me was a sense of opportunity, because once I got out of that, I knew how valuable peace, quiet, cleanliness was. And you never quite escape it, you know, because I'm sometimes driving around in my little sports car today, and I'll look at a little area of bush and I think, well, that would be a good place to sleep. You know,
wow.
So you never actually get rid of it.
You wrestled with all the traumas from those years? Have you gone into them? Or as you get older, do you find those memories from childhood come back more clearly? Things saying, come on, heal me, bring me out, bring me to the light.
Well, there's two things that happen. The first thing is, the only way you can survive that, in my experience, and there may be other people who have different experiences and how they survive, but mine was to take all those bad memories and put them into a silver box and use silver solder and put them away and forget them. Often people have said to me, don't you feel that you should get even with those people who abused you sexually and physically? But if I spent my life trying to do that, they would have won.
So you were sexually abused in foster homes?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of times.
And they knew your background, and they still took advantage of this little boy.
Well, it's a complicated process, because you know, the kids are often looking for affection, and then these caregivers are, some of them genuinely, I think, want to look after the kids, but then they have certain you know, tendencies in terms of being homosexual, and so it all gets horribly blurred, you know. And
Ray, do you realise you're to survive this, you're right. It's up there with an Ed Hillary climbing Everest. I don't care what anyone says. An adult who can come through a childhood like this and then grow themselves and then give back to society. That's an enormous achievement.
Well, part of it was, you know, like when I got out of the orphanages, one of the big mistakes I made was that I thought that being loved would make me happy. Mm. You know, and I to do that, I would have numerous girlfriends, and if they loved me, I felt that for the first time somebody was looking after me and interested in me and wanting to love me. But it wasn't until I learned that the best way for happiness was to help other people and to love other people that I was redeemed. And it happened almost miraculously with my two daughters, in that when I was working overseas for development work and doing stuff in blindness, I'd often, you know, come back, and when I would come back from a trip with my you know, family, and these two little people would rush and hug me, and at that moment when they hugged me, I knew what I had missed.
You know, absolutely.
I knew I should have had that. And that's when it gets you. That's when it gets you, because how could you be that awful to a kid? How could you be that brutal to a kid? Because they're so pure, you know, and that's the only time that the little box just peeped open a little bit and then put it shut and get on, because I don't want to be a victim of all that horror. So my kids save me every day because of their imagination and what they might be.
Having said that, my way was with my childhood and a mother who drank, to open the box up and go, come on, all of you, Pandora's box, all of you, come up. I'm going to face you. It's a hell of a journey. You've got to have the enormous guts to go through that way as well. Mm. But I remember an early counsellor saying, if you nail it shut, it's like Chernobyl. They've covered it with concrete, but a cloud of black sometimes will come out.
Yeah,
and you'll go, what is that? Do you get that sometimes, a cloud of black, where it just hits you on that day? Or do you have any other things apart from you know, needing to have lots of women in that stage of your life, and you've got past that. Have you ever given in to drinking or drugs to try to numb that pain that was there from childhood?
No, it's because I think what happened with me was I knew what the problem was. I knew that the abuse wasn't going to go away. So my SOP, my standard operating procedure, was to run away. And so I got, it was like catch 22. I just practiced running away. So I'd run away for a week and take enough food with me, and I'd have to come back, and then I'd practice a bit more. And I knew that I could reinvent myself by getting on the train and getting off at another train station. There would always be a little place there that with the waiting room, and it had a coal fire in it, and it was kept going all winter. And so I could go in there and sleep in there, and I knew I could do that. And so I could escape from a cold dormitory where I might be worried about somebody coming in and climbing into bed and be in this place on my own. So I knew there was an escape, and that's always been the promise of life for me, that there's something better if things are awful. And that's the thing that sustains you, because you don't have to be a victim of the circumstances you're in. You can always change it. The only things that happen, which are quite reverse, is that I learned very early on in the piece that I was living on the streets of London, but I had a school uniform, and that allowed me to go into places that were like Lion's Tea House and have a cup of tea, and I could stay there in the warmth, looking like a school child, reasonably well dressed, and I could go to the Hilton Hotel and sit in their lobby. And so I became an expert at cleaning up.
So resilient.
So I was going into these hotels and cleaning up in their bathrooms. And what I also found, there was all these conferences going on, and there'd be this food, and I'd sneak in and get the food.
Resilient.
And so ironically, the only thing that's kind of connected, I remember being doing a talk, so now I give talks up and down the country, and I remember being in one of the hotels which remained nameless, and I'd just come out of the conference, and in the room next door were always this spread of everything and all these little miniature bottles of whiskey and things, and I nicked them, because that was like that world that I did. I didn't need to nick them, but it was kind of like deja vu, and I thought, this is it's what made me what survived was the adroitness of just dealing with the circumstances.
But you know what I mean when I say the Ed Hillary, it's your own personal mountain you're climbing. It's your own incredible challenges of life. You've come here and you've manifested them early. What made the turnaround at 14? You start this going to the library, as I said in the introduction, and then you start to read and self-educate. And then what happened?
Well, the good thing about education is, my education was different. I didn't learn algebra and all those things. So I was reading the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is like Google of the day. So my knowledge base was quite diverse, and I was making my own batteries under the railway bridge out of dynamos from bicycles. I was building bicycles from scrapyards and selling them to my school chums. And I realised my aim at 14 was to own my own bicycle shop, because I was actually had quite a thriving business.
So you were a little inventor then, even. You had that kind of brain.
Well, I've always had, I was doing three paper rounds. I did one in the morning and one in the evening. And one I subcontracted to my mate by lending him my bike, and I got half his income.
Entrepreneurial.
So I was always an entrepreneur. I always found a way of, making something work.
But you met a teacher who took you under her wing, didn't you?
Yeah,
and she got you into agricultural college. What was that?
There was a guy called Jack Wise. What happened was I because I was worried about being caught, I would go down to this buttress under this pedestrian bridge where I was hiding, and climbed up different ways. And I had this little fishing line, which was connected to a rope, and the fishing line could be hidden in the cracks, and I'd pull it down, the rope would come down, I'd climb up and get up to the buttress, and I was 14 and I was fit, and so no other drunk or was going to find me or get me, so I was safe. And
when
so I was
up on, tucked in right underneath the bridge.
Yeah, tucked under the rope, so I was fine. And I had I found in an allotment a little aluminium frame from a discarded glass house, and I covered that in polythene, and then inside that I had all these fridge cartons which I'd made into a big box, which I climbed in like a big sleeping bag, and I was warm as toast. And I'd
did you cry for yourself? Did you feel sad?
No, I was bloody happy. That was the best time of my life.
Because you were safe?
Because I was safe, because there's nothing worse than lying in bed waiting for that door to open.
It
might be just one place. The abuse was kind of different in the sense that you might be with one family, and in those days a family could rent you in the sense that they would get a certain amount of stipend for looking after you as a foster giver. And I remember there was this couple when they presented very well when I went there. The son was the same age as me and he had a nice school uniform and she was a nice woman. And she went through the interview process and I got billeted with them. But what would happen is every evening was they'd make some toast and jam and give it to me. And then they'd go out and I'd see them sitting in a restaurant having a nice evening meal. And they'd just leave me at home with the toast and jam. And so the abuse can be quite complicated.
Absolutely.
You know.
What's your advice, by the way, before we move on to how you created, came to New Zealand? What's your advice to someone going through that who might be listening to that, who might be listening to your story? I mean, yours is in a way a rags to riches story, but what's your advice to them right now if you're in the midst of some horror like this?
Well, what probably the best example is one of my best friends, well, I had two best friends commit suicide. One of them was a guy that was in the bed next to me and he was being sodomized. And as that was going on, the guy was looking at me and I was a victim of that too. But what was far worse was my friend looking at me, looking for help, and I couldn't help him. And this went on for a long time. And afterwards, I thought, well, I've got to fix this. So I went along with this kid to the head teacher and said, look, this is what's happening. You've got to stop it, because that was me empowered. What happened was, and this is often what happens in life, is that the policy takes over and the head teacher said, look, he's not a bad guy, we'll fix it, he won't do it anymore, and just don't do anything. And then what happened, of course, this guy felt rejected by this kid and started to physically abuse him, and that was too much, so he went into the toilet and hung himself. And I just took off. I ran away. I wasn't frightened of the teacher, I just ran away because I'd stayed for him, kind of. But what that taught me was that, and then I had another friend who was a dear friend of mine who committed suicide, and he used to love driving, and he drove to the end of the beach and got to the end of the beach, took some pharmaceutical products and killed himself. And he kind of ran out of road. And I think the advice that I would have in all these situations is that everybody has a milk bottle moment where everything collapses and everything seems desperate and hopeless.
Yes.
But if you can live through that, there is a tomorrow. That's all you can do.
Yes.
If you can get through that one moment, because both of those people, if we could have worked through it, he could have run away with me and we could have escaped, or the other guy could have just not run out of road. So it's about living through that absolute moment of desperation. And sometimes you see it in movies displayed where somebody pulls the trigger and the gun doesn't go off. And
yes.
They just that one moment. Because what I know is that you can live through these things. And there is a lot of beauty that comes out of that pain. You know, I'm the most resilient person on the whole planet.
You really are. I mean, this lifetime, what do you think what lessons have you learned so far? And you're still learning, but what have you learned so far from
life? Well, life is precious and you have to use it. So one of the reasons that I do all the work that I do is simply because I've got to make sense of that awfulness. I've got to do something extraordinary to make that annealing that I had, and I like to think of it as annealing, to make
yes.
me hard and tough. If I can make sense of that by doing something extraordinary. So we did some maths the other day, a good friend of mine, Dr. Sandra Rawit, who we built a laboratory to make intraocular lenses in Nepal. And we collapsed the price of intraocular lenses from about $360 down to about $5. And that meant that globally we could do cataract surgery. So it had a huge impact on the ability to do cataract surgery. And he wrote to me recently, and he had an autobiography, and he credited me with building the laboratory and just turning things around for them in Nepal. He's, by his calculation, by the time my eldest daughter is my age, there will be some 100 million people who can see because of what I did. And so that's worth the annealing. But I'm not finished. I've got a low-cost incubator. I've got these nutritional products. I've probably got, if you look at the epidemiology of New Zealand, the amount of Chardonnay I drink and all those things, I've probably got about 10 years to 15 years. And I want to make those precious days count by doing something worthwhile. Because then when they do put the coffin lid on, I know I've done something. I would like to think, though, just as they're putting the coffin lid on, it squeaks out and a little hand comes up, I've got another idea. The next best thing to that, and this is for the listeners, is if I can do that, then you can do that.
That's the thing. Your life stands as an inspiration. But you said I had to get tough and hard. But you're not tough and hard. You're full of compassion. Mm. For me, it's that kneeling moment is where I found, or all those kneeling moments, where I found enormous courage within myself. Mm. But I don't have to choose to be hard to the world. I can still have this compassionate heart. And you seem the same.
Oh, absolutely.
Care about people.
Oh, well, when I was... young and 16, 17 and wanting to be loved by all these young women, it didn't make me happy. But when I see somebody get their sight back with something I've been involved in, or I'd love to go down to Queen Street and give these bars out to the homeless guys because it's probably the best thing that they can do. Because that makes sense of everything.
I do want to ask you, how do you feel when you drive down Queen Street or even to South Auckland and you see this enormous number of homeless people that have come on our roads and on our streets in the last decade? It breaks my heart every time. It's not the New Zealand you came to in 1973, is it?
No, well, I mean, New Zealand's, we're a transformational country. We're going from collective society to an individual society. And ironically, our GDP is increasing generally and people have more disposable income, but we still have growing societal problems. The number of kids who go to school hungry, and I can fix that. I mean, I think that was the thing with the bars. We had a look at it and said, in that bar is an apple, pretty much two bowls of pasta and a whole bowl of peas for fibre and so on. So we've got all these things that really will make you fill you up and give you good nutrition and give you all the vitamins and amino acids you need for good physiological and cognitive skills. And if you can get that into them, then they've got a chance. Because if you can't learn if you're upset and hangry.
So where will these bars distribute? You talk about potentially the homeless, but schools? You're starting with school children?
Well, it was designed for school children between the ages of 4 to 14. So it's got the right ingredients for about a third of their requirements for all these things. And it was in recognition that the fact is that we've got a lot of people involved in distributing fresh food to kids and also growing food from the garden to the table. But the reality is that often the societal issues get in the way, that mum's just so busy, she doesn't have time to cook stuff. So if you've got a lunchbox, if you whack one of these in, you've pretty much got a whole concoction of things that you would normally put into them. It's not a panacea for not and a replacement for having good meals. And we've actually got a school pack where we teach people about nutrition and also how mum can make some cheap meals, that she can readily do that the kids will like. But it is a magic bullet in the sense that if you get one of these into a kid once a day, it not only allows them to have all the vitamins and minerals they need, about a third of what they need for a day, but it also enables them to get more protein out of the other things they have. So, for instance, if you've got a rice diet, you've got 12% rice, but you can't get all that protein out because it's got these limiting amino acids, leucine and lysine. This is full of leucine and lysine, and that allows you to digest more protein out of your rice.
It helps your body break it
down. Yeah, that's right.
How affordable are they? How will you be able to get these?
They'll be in supermarkets for about $1.50 and for charitable purposes in schools for about $1. So that's another real win. So this is a charitable thing. It's not like making a huge business out of it.
Yes.
But we want to get them out at scale in New Zealand. We've been inundated with kids from schools requesting them. The problem is for the teachers, these kids front up at school hungry and they haven't got any lunch box.
And you
either.
Can't learn when you're hungry and you're
we
small.
We can't, No, there's a direct relationship between cognitive ability and, in fact, if you get good amino acids into them, it improves their cognitive outcomes. So there's clinical trials that show this. So
all the way through this dialogue, there's peppered with your science background. So you come from this boy at 14, taking refuge in a library, learning about science. You then got an agricultural degree. Mm. What happened then? Well, you decided sort of on the spur of the moment to come to New Zealand in 73.
Well, not
how did we end up with you here?
Well, what happened was, and it was to do with that forming of Mr. Ray, in the sense that all I wanted to do when I got out of the orphanages tell people to have this, you've got to have a plan, a life plan. And I have a life plan typically that lasts 10 years and then I change it depending on what I've learned. But
so what's yours at the moment?
This well, to change the world and get the incubators out and get these nutritional products out at scale, real scale.
So a life plan is I'm going to achieve this within 10 years.
Yes, that's right. So that's the game plan. But in those days, as a 14-year-old, I wanted to be a millionaire by the time I was 26. And I wanted to be loved by as many women as possible.
You achieved the second, it seems. Did you achieve the first?
Yes, yes.
I
scored on both fronts.
Wow. How did you make your money by 26?
Right? Well, what happened was I got the first job I had after the Agricultural Research College was in an analytical testing laboratory where we used to take samples of milk and foodstuffs. And ironically, I was doing exactly this. I was taking a product like this off the market, finding out what was in it, and publishing a report for the government. We were a government, licensed government analyst as a subcontractor. And I worked at that laboratory as a junior technician. And over the next two or three years, I became much more knowledgeable. And because I had developed this radar accent, which was a posh accent, I could actually go out and engage with clients. So if somebody wanted to have SO2, sulfur dioxide preservative in their sausages analyzed, I'd go out to them and say, I'm Sir Ray Avery from Southeastern Laboratories. I can analyse your SO2 for you. It'll cost you £4.17 a sample.
And of course, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
So I was the front
man.
And then what
so
happened?
So how did you turn that into millions?
Well, what happened was that the company I was working for was owned by this very aristocratic guy from London, and he would come down to us once a month to visit us. And while he was driving down one day, he was killed in a car crash. And what happened was he'd sent me to London to set up a satellite laboratory. It was really not a proper laboratory, it was just an office. And my job was to go out and get clients to give us their samples. We would send them down to Canterbury where we'd analyse them in the existing laboratory. So it was really just an extension, you know, it wasn't a real testing laboratory. And they sent me up there to set it up because I had the knowledge and the vocabulary to actually do it. And of course, what had happened was I'd used my own credit card to do the printing of the stuff, and I couldn't get reimbursed because the company now was in disrepair because the family were arguing over who was going to inherit the company. So there I was in London, broke, with a company name that I couldn't use, and a maxed out credit card. And I think this is one of the stories about how you survive. And so what you do is you say, well, what I know it's munted, but how can we fix it? And so I thought, well, what's happening here is I was going up there to set up a laboratory that didn't really exist. I was going to take samples from all these people, send them to a laboratory for testing, give them a report and charge them for it. So why don't I do that? So I did. So I went out to other laboratories and got them to do the analysis. And I was the man. So I formed a company, which was just a shell company. And I would go and see you and say, I'll analyze your sausages. You'd give me the sausages. I'd send them down to the analytical lab, get the results, send you the results. And I'd charge you the cost of analysis plus 20%.
You were like clipping the ticket.
I was clipping the ticket.
So that's that entrepreneurial side that's come through as well as the science side.
Yeah. So,
but I love that question. It's like, it's munted. It's looking hopeless. What can we do? Yeah. That's the resilience.
Well,
that's
your not resilience. Just resilience. It's just simple physics to me, in the sense that let's take when I was in Eritrea at the end of the 30-year war, we were building a laboratory there, and we had this equipment that had come from the Fred Hollis Foundation in Australia, and none of it worked. It was all horrible. It didn't work. Couldn't make lenses. And so everybody had put their heart on their sleeves to make this laboratory work. And we built the laboratory to international standards, and that was certified, but the equipment just didn't work. So I remember all the engineers getting into the room, and they all looked at it and they said, well, look, it's absolutely buggered. That'll never work. And if you think about that statement, there's no coming back from that statement. So what I would do is I would say, okay, so it's buggered, so how are we going to fix it?
Because that
changes the dynamic.
You know, Ray, within that, you're very much in the Kiwi zeitgeist, because that's been very much the Kiwi ethos since earliest time. Maori are amazingly adaptive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think even early colonists had to find a way through. You've got that. We are so lucky to have you. A lot of this, the rest of your life story, people, if they want to investigate more of Ray Avery, can find it in your book, Rebel with a Cause. You are launching this food this week. We'll keep a bit of a watching brief, but I appreciate you coming along. It's been a real delight, and I think there are some of those statements you've given today that will truly inspire people. Thank you, Ray Avery.
Thank you too.
Love it. Kia ora.